We're back again for part three of our epic four-part podcast of Doctor Who Season 3. This is Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast coming at you live from the security kitchen.
Hooray!
I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
And I'm here too.
And we're starting off with a classic of Doctor Who. Nathan, I'm gagging you for now. The Massacre. Take it away, Richard.
Okay, I begged for this on bent knee.
And other things that we're not allowed to mention.
So many reasons. It happens to occur on my birthday. It's one of, I think, the most interesting points in modern Euro history, in that it's never has a story had a more apt name than this. It's about the conflagration of religion that's been burning away pretty much for the last 1,000 years. Protestants and Catholics coming together, and just the incendiary results of that in a modern city, Paris. Okay, we're talking the TARDIS lands in 1572. We're at the point of the Renaissance. We're at a point now where modern humanity, modern learned men take note as being educated, civilized, responding to the world, and then all hell breaks loose. This is something that really talks about a whole lot of things that are completely outside the domain of Doctor Who. And one of the reasons that people, when I'm asked, why are you a fan of Doctor Who? I said, because it's everything you want it to be. You can drop it into anything and it will take it on board and do something really interesting with it. And hopefully, and this certainly does for me, give you a perspective you might not have thought of before. Nathan, you're a fan of The Massacre too, aren't you?
Well, listen, I watched The Massacre for the first time to prepare for the podcast. And I had already, even before the idea of the podcast came up, I'd already kind of had the idea that I would watch Doctor Who, you know, all the way through the 60s. And I've got several friends, we call it the great journey of life, you know, like Horns of Nymon style, where they just watch, an episode. And you've been doing it as well with Rod.
Yeah,
haven't
you, yeah.
Brendan.
So we're almost up to the Horns of Nymon, actually.
Oh, lucky you. And I had long heard that this was terrific. I think Cornell, Day and Topping rave about it in the Discontinuity Guide.
I like it. Yeah.
Sandifer says that it's, you know, extraordinary. And,
Sandifer,
you know,
likes it.
Yeah, one of the best things. Okay. And so I was prepared to be impressed. And it was just so boring. I really, like I know that I've been flogging to death the idea that stories are much better when they have, you know,
no flange-faced villains in this.
That's
one.
Right. Are you saying the cliffhanger for episode 2 should have been Stephen walks into the De Medici throne room and the Queen uses her perception filter and suddenly turns around and says, "You dare disturb me at this time?"
Yeah, that would be greater if she pulled a rubber face off and she was a Jagger off. You know? I just found this so incredibly tiresome. And I'll tell you why.
Of course.
Like, every time we go to the past, we spend time in a tavern and then prison. You know, it's tavern, then prison, and we get that again here. The Doctor's barely in it, and yeah. Like, and everyone goes, "Oh, he does a masterful acting thing as the Abbot of Amboise, where he doesn't do all of his tics and all that." But the Abbot of Amboise is only in it for like a couple of minutes, and then he's dead. And like Stephen, who we've already said is someone with no discernible characteristics, who isn't, you know, like, he's a great actor, he's quite charismatic to watch, but he's not a character in the way that Ian and Barbara
Until
were characters.
Now, this is the first story where the Doctor is absent, as you say, and
so he
and
has
to carry the narrative.
He has to carry the narrative, but there's not enough there to carry the narrative.
And I don't know that you need a backstory. I think the casual viewer, and not everyone was watching every week, would just take him as being...
But he could have just been some guy who came across from London, you know, and didn't know the local thing. I mean,
does that matter?
I think it matters, because why am I watching this, you know, like, it's not Doctor Who, then. The Doctor's not in it. Stephen has, like, nothing that happens to Stephen couldn't have happened to someone who had just come across this week. There's whole scenes where they're explaining the details of this historical period to each other. That scene with the Queen, where it's all just huge, huge wadges of exposition where they're all explaining to each other
what's going on here as well, because I actually love an exposition. I have to say, I love a plot dump. This story takes place the day after the marriage of Protestant Henri of Navarre to Charles Neuf's sister, so Charles IX. Navarre was a principality at the south of France. We should say that at this stage in history, France is all the reasons that I'm going into now that Nathan loves this story, all their background history stuff.
Tell us more about France.
I love it when you get
real stuff and real history thrown into Doctor Who, because it becomes more dangerous, the whole stuff, if you can't change time. I just think it's more interesting because it's relevant to real events. It's not simply Planet Zog with the Zogoids. It's actually something you can look up, and there's a whole lot more going on. And I think the narrative takes it more seriously. The cast does. The writers and directors take it more seriously because it's based on real events. It might be a prejudice to science fiction, certainly at this time. As we've said before, science fiction was predominantly the nature and state of the pulp magazines and the Saturday matinee. Yeah,
this is more highbrow than that.
Yeah, it is. But it also is able to then plumb greater depths and lateralness in characterization, which for me, Doctor Who is about how much of a reaction and characterization you get in the story. It's not for me so much about whether or not they've got a rubbery face.
Oh, no, but there's no characterization either. Everyone's
Moment? The players in this are absolutely fabulous, and you don't need to see this. I recommend that if you want to have a look at this, let's just listen to the audio version of it, because it works beautifully as a radio play.
It's not helped by the reconstruction.
I wouldn't bother the reconstruction.
There's like one picture of... Yeah. What's the...
Gaston.
Yeah, there's one picture of Gaston. And they just Photoshop him over different backgrounds and stuff.
It would be very distracting trying to watch a recon on this.
Although, I really enjoyed the recon. It helped the story come to life for me. And when we finished watching the recon, because after each story, I take Damrod's reaction, anything he wants to say about it, and he actually said, actually, give me a minute, I'm still processing this. And he hates the recons. He watched them, but, you know, he's like, I want moving images. He said, I actually didn't miss the moving images this time. Mm. I know nothing about this period in history. I'd heard the name Huguenots.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what happened. This story makes me want to find out more, and no other Doctor Who historical has made me want to find out more about the period than this story.
I agree.
To me, in a way, Rod is my acid test for a lot of Doctor Who stories. Because, interestingly, as I just said, we're halfway through Nightmare of Eden. He gave City of Death an 8. He gave Creature from the Pit 8.5.
Yeah, okay.
You know, so it's very it's very interesting to see his reactions. The Massacre, I'm sorry, Nathan, but I'm with Richard on this one. I think it's a wonderful piece of drama. I think it's a great vehicle for Peter Purvis. And I think that Peter Purvis being... Stephen, I should say, rather, being a space pilot is not so important here as the morality of Stephen's character, and as someone who has just been through a massacre and has just seen his friends die and has seen people die specifically for him. Because Katarina sacrifices herself for him. Brett Vian is killed because he's trying to help him and the Doctor.
Yep.
Sarah sacrifices herself for him and the Doctor. He is so sick and tired of death, but he can do nothing to stop it. And it also raises the question of, where was the Doctor? You know, he was off trying to meet the scientists. If the Doctor has been here, what could he have done? And a bit like Dalek's Master Plan, it's like the Doctor can't do anything.
Yeah, and that's...
But here, for some reason, it feels better.
It does feel better. Should we talk a bit about the story? Because a lot, you know, maybe the person listening doesn't
all know right.
what this
yes,
show
sorry,
is.
I didn't interrupt
Stephen
you.
Turns up and goes to a pub. Then he meets some people who are not very interesting. The Doctor goes away and talks to Binro the Heretic from the 16th
century. Oh, it's a bit Rybos Operation.
Not Binro the Heretic, actually. It's Coordinator Engen.
No, I know, but do you know what I mean?
He's Susan to his mates. Didn't Susan Engen play Vivian Fay?
when I say Binro the Heretic, I don't mean the actor. I mean, he's someone...
Charles
Preston.
All of this is going on, but
making it, you're saying it's, you know, the when the modern you know, like, yeah. this. The striking thing about this is it happens so close to our own time, and it happens. It happens
with very much modern politics,
just
involved.
As modernity is kind of, and that's what Chitty's character.
Preslan is a scientist.
Charles Preslan.
Preslan is a scientist in Paris. When the term itself was almost a reason for expulsion. Under the current Catholic rule. Really interesting times. Catherine de' Medici was the mother of King Charles the Ninth.
See, I'm just falling asleep during that sentence.
Well, I tell you what. One of the things she's credited for is introducing modern French cuisine. The tropes of this is what I was looking for of
a drink.
of Italian cooking were brought to France. So modern cooking actually started. This is not me saying this. This is the wonderful Larousse, the wonderful Larousse and his Larousse Gastronomique. It's got three fantastic performances from three major players of the time you just wouldn't expect in these roles. As you mentioned, it's got Eric Chitty as Preslan, a scientist who's when research was something that was very dangerous to do. You've got Admiral de Coligny, Gaspard de Coligny, played by Leonard Sachs, who is our very own Barossa in the Arc of Infinity. We own him. And better than that, Eric Thompson, the father of Emma Thompson, the father of Emma Thompson, and the author and the complete rewriting of the Magic Roundabout. It's amazingly bizarre thing. As Gaston,
I didn't notice that. Who's he?
That's Eric Thompson. Now, Eric Thompson was known at the time as pretty much the Peter Purvis of the 60s, in that he was the face of children's television in England, and he, the gentle, lovely make do and mend guy who was the go-to whenever you wanted someone charming to talk to the kids. And as Emma Thompson speaks of, because he died quite young, Emma Thompson herself speaks of her father as being all of these extraordinary things. Here he plays a volatile, acerbic, pick up a sword and cut his way through the opposition character. Everyone's playing against type. And better than that, the reason I really love this story is not just the history stuff, although it falls on my birthday, which is in fact the day of the massacre, so I'm kind of resonant for that, is that you really get to see Billy shine and stick one in the eye to John Wiles, who was trying to get rid of him, because he plays the dual role, not to spoil this for you, although it's actually intrinsic to the story. You're not meant to know how this is going to end up.
Whether it's a dual role or whether
Billy,
it's actually the doctor.
For some reason, Billy plays the Abbot of Amboise, and hence the confusion and the narrative being able to go the way it does when Stephen sees him in the street and thinks that the Abbot is the doctor. So a whole lot of confusion, terrible things happen because of this. Billy plays the Abbot, contrary to all expectations, absolutely note and word perfect. Not a lot of lines in it, but he is phlegmatic and cold and measured and controlled. There's none of the usual things that we assume is something of Billy's own person in the part. Absolutely not. Which makes you think at this point, even the fluffs maybe are deliberate. Maybe they are. Because, who can say it? Because he just gets this so cold and so right.
But
and
he is barely in it. And like the Abbot isn't in it all that much. And the other thing is, you know, this is just so worthy and such an important document of historical blah, 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 that,
I just think
that
also
having
a
stupid
story.
Science fiction conceit where it just so happens that the Abbot looks exactly like the Doctor for no reason at all, that kind of undermines it a little bit
But
as
I like
well.
That it's kind of the oddness of it, the fact that this isn't... It plays with history, but then it throws in fantasy. It doesn't have to be always BSF. Doctor Who can be anything.
Which, Nathan, is exactly what you like.
I love is that we've also got references, of course it's my story, I can keep going with this, just like Brendan Carter Nathan last time. This, if you've read any of Brian Greene's stuff, he's the...
That's from Beverly Hills 902.
He is indeed. He's the kind of scary, smiling scientist, the Canadian scientist, who's written some fantastic books and done some great TV shows, even though it often feels like he's selling Amway when you watch him on TV, but he writes really well. And the last chapter in one of his last books, which I have just here to hand, we'll mention at the end, is that modern physics seems to be showing that we are a holographic three-dimensional representation of an alternate universe of a surface reality, and that we are a mere reflection via a black hole of that reality. Therefore, the idea of the Doctor and other Time Lords, as we've seen, the second Doctor has the face of Salamander.
The third Doctor looks like that.
The 12th Doctor looks like that bloke in old Rome, and the third Doctor looks like a washerwoman from an electronics and mining base in the middle of Wales. I just like that there are so many things that Doctor Who can reference and bring in, and the fantasy side of this is that the doppelganger of the Doctor is just a lovely little conceit in what is otherwise
a really hard story.
Can we get to the girls? Because this is all about what we can do to the girls.
Could I just say something about the... just to build on what you were saying about the abbot having the same face as the Doctor. For those of you who don't know, around this time, William Hartnell was actually pitching story ideas.
Ah, yes, to the production crew.
And one of the story ideas he pitched, and he sent a letter in reply to a fan that... has been reprinted in a book somewhere. I'm sorry, I don't know what it is. The Son of Doctor Who was one of Billy's ideas. And it seems like most of the actors who play the Doctor say they were getting slightly restless playing the one part all the time.
Yeah.
So Billy's idea was that Doctor Who's villainous son would turn up with his own TARDIS and be played by Billy in a black wig.
As his younger self.
Because Billy looks 10 years older as the Doctor than he did in real life. So it's feasible that he could look...
He had had a bit of a hard time.
It's feasible that he could look younger with makeup and whatnot. And that didn't happen. But there is a theory, which makes a lot of sense, that the Abbot of Amboise, Billy playing the Abbot of Amboise, was John Wiles' way of doing two things. A, it was taking the emphasis away from Billy because... the Abbot of Amboise is in so little of the story.
Yeah, it's like in two scenes and one of them is lying dead in the gutter. I mean, really, it's not that big
a deal. It was a way to... Some people think it was a way for John Wiles to prove that, look, you can't play another part, you can't even play your own part. And much like Tom Baker later in The Deadly Assassin, where Tom turned around and said, I don't need an assistant, and Philip Hinchcliffe said, we're going to give you a story to show you it doesn't work. And it happened to be brilliant.
Yeah,
just like Billy happens to be brilliant. Nothing comes of it. Billy doesn't play another part again on the show. But as he was saying, he was bloody good.
Really good.
You were going to say something about the women.
Well, thank you for mentioning that, though, because it makes me think that... maybe Donald Tosh was more on Billy's side than we reckon.
I certainly get that impression hearing Donald talk now.
He's a damn good writer, too. He wrote this.
It's John Lucarotti's best script when it's actually so much Donald Tosh that John Lucarotti refused to have his name on it.
Yeah, Lucarotti kind of didn't.
Who's credited?
No one's credited for episodes 1 to 3.
That's correct.
Really?
Yeah. Luke Arotti and there's no writer credit. Yeah, because by the time of episode 4, the head of serials, I believe,
said you need a writer's credit.
So they both agreed.
Someone to blame in 48 years' time.
Because what happened with this is that Donald Tosh had to rewrite the scripts, but more interestingly, and this is something that Luca Rotti was really opposed to and why he took his name off the rights, he brought about the duality of the Doctor and the Abbot. In the original scripts, Billy was in the scenes against, not exactly up against the Abbot as far as we know, but it was always clear that they were separate people. Why this is so good is that we're seeing it from Stephen's face. We don't know that the Abbot is not
until
the Doctor.
Until he's dead in the ditch.
Do we?
That could be the Doctor dead in the ditch.
We've just seen two companions. Companions killed in the previous series.
I don't buy that.
Okay. It's certainly one of the best cliffhangers of the whole series, which is what I'm saying.
And I'm sorry to cut you off, Richard, but Nathan, by that logic, we should never have a cliffhanger with the Doctor in danger because we know it's not effective because we know he can get out of it.
That's not at all. It's how will he get out of it. It's not will he get out of it. It's not like next week will I come back and the main character will be dead and then the show will have to go on without him. The Doctor in Peril cliffhanger works because we're going, ooh, how's he going to get out of that?
Yeah, you don't get much more imperiled than being dead in a gutter.
Yeah, well, then we know it's not him. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just exhausts me, this story. And it really is them experimenting with getting rid of Hartnell and, like, flailing. They don't know what to do. And so they hit, let's try with Stephen as the leading man. Let's marginalise Hartnell, who is barely in it for four episodes. And I just think that the result is just not very interesting. You know, it's not a Doctor Who story. And the Doctor, like, the Doctor leaves, and all of the, like, massacre is sort of realised, and this is the recon, and I don't know how it was realised in the actual thing, but it's realised with sort of contemporary engravings showing pictures of people being massacred and
stuff. Yes, that was the case in the
original. There's no even real peril. It's sort of just a historical thing that happened. It had happened before the story came. It still happened when the story ended. We've had no effect on it. We haven't really learned from it. Like, have we learned something about religious intolerance? Not really. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's all just...
Oh, I have to...
Terribly...
Sorry, David, I have to disagree there. I'll adjust my monoid wig in my Margaret role. No, I think that... I'm sorry, you're wrong, David. You're wrong. I think
Judith Bruce is about to come out again.
This time she did. We miss her. There's just lovely stuff. This is some really serious things going on here, and as the friction between Protestant and Catholic. Look, in Australia at this time in the early 60s, you still, as a Catholic person, couldn't be a member of the Australia Club. There were lots of positions that were not open to you because Protestants and the Masons, in fact, were still running the jobs and the business. You could rise to a certain high place in the public service, but that's about it. So this story would have been very relevant for a lot of people watching it at the time. It's very much a modern story.
The Catholics are evil in it. Do you know what I mean? It's like the Catholics are bad guys. We're automatically on the side of the Protestants. They're doing a bit of massacring.
This is what I love about this. Admiral de Coligny, the Leonard Sachs character, is the biggest warmonger of the lot. He's the one in this story who's advocating war with Spain as an alliance to get in with the Dutch. And I'm not going into the background and the history of the story because you know I'm busting to. But... because it's really complex, and I can talk for 10 minutes about the history of this, which is why I love it. There's so much complexity in the backstory, whether or not the casual viewer would have known it then.
Well, you certainly wouldn't have got any of it on screen, because it's just lots of people in rooms talking to each other in a set that's a kind of...
Yeah, tavern. Possibly. Although, sadly, we don't know what the direction would have been like, but the audio performances are certainly fantastic. The final scenes, and Tosh chose these drawings, because, you know, obviously they had a budget consideration. Yeah, so when they actually show the massacre, what they actually showed was contemporary engravings, you know, of the time, of what was going on. And the BBC was apparently, you know, in inverted commas, flooded with letters because the engravings themselves were so violent and expletive. So this would have, I think, had a lot of temerity to it as well for going out there, but a lot of texture. I think that this season is actually pretty fantastic for its experimentalism. And I love this one for giving me, as my kind of viewer, I can't be the only one out there who really loves
but it's
strength and complexity.
Absolutely. No. I like complexity. I like strength. My objection is I don't think this has either of those. I think it's really talky. It's full of exposition. It has none of the characters that I'm interested in watching. Okay. No one really seems to learn anything from it. It's...
just like life.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's it. That's the old quote. If I want a long, boring story with no point to it, I've got my life. You know, like, I don't want to watch the massacre.
Can I just urge everyone? This is one of the... The reason I love this and I begged for this story, I wasn't given it, is because of the performances and nuances and the language. And also, it's beautifully done. Tosh is a really good writer, and he really, really cements that for me in this. The man can write. And just the tonalities and textures in the performances. It's a lovely radio play, and it's really worth listening to. Can I just say, I also miss out on someone I would have loved. It does get a bit Jennifer Saunders with the Mumaset accent, but the character that Anne Robertson plays in this, who is...
Anne Chaplet.
She's really lovely, and she has this... absolutely demonstrable squeeze on Stephen. There's a real crush happening here. Mm. And it's a lovely moment.
And it's handled maturely.
Very maturely, thank you.
She is a strong female character. She's the first strong female character we've had since, not including recurring or regular characters.
She however, you sort of whiny Sarah. And panicky she's, stuff in
she's
the all, thing.
No, she's strong, and she's the first underclass, not just working class. She's the first modern slave class that actually gets a voice.
And they kill her, spoiler alert.
Well, they do. Yeah.
Or do they?
Are we up to the point where we get to the last 5 minutes?
Yes, can we
minutes?
Just get rid of this story? Well, okay. Honestly, it's so terrible.
Before we go on to the bad thing that happens in the last 5 minutes, let's go on to the good thing, which is Stephen's tirade at the Doctor.
Oh, it's so nice. He's going to storm out.
Oh, yeah, that would be great.
Okay.
Let's not someone's lost their beagle or their tennis ball on Wimbledon Common.
Okay. Let's put a cork on that, Nathan. Let's put a cork on that and just talk about Stephen's just utter fed up outrage.
Stephen has had a year of seeing everyone bogged off, everyone dead, and the Doctor has a chance to rescue a girl who has actively assisted them in this story and actually, in a way, allowed them both to be saved and come through this. And the Doctor just leaves her in Paris. And the only advice he says is stay the shut up for 4 days inside because everyone else is going to get horribly murdered.
Yeah. And when you consider where Stephen's character has come from, you know, he's been imprisoned by the Mechanoids for 2 or 3 years, you know, and so, you know, he desperately wants his freedom, but as soon as he gets out, like, he has a couple of nice adventures with the Doctor and Vicky, and then he just travels around seeing people horribly murdered,
as Nathan would say.
people helping him, and, you know, each of the leading up situations, he's like, yeah, the Doctor can't do anything about that, like, Katarina, the Doctor can't do anything about that, Sarah, the Doctor was in danger as well. No, I'm agreeing with that, but, yeah, as you say, the Doctor has a chance to do something.
This is the first time the Doctor can actually enter into the narrative and save a girl, and he doesn't do it. Is it because she doesn't remind him of his granddaughter?
Well, I think it's actually...
Because that might be a reason why the next one's allowed to stay.
I think it might actually more be an indication of what he said way back in the Aztecs, if you can't change history.
Not even one judge.
And unlike a lot of other Doctors, he actually stands by that.
But that's for major characters. He's always allowed himself to assist minor characters, and you can't
He didn't assist Richard. He didn't assist King Richard.
Richard is not a major character.
No, but as you said...
No, but that's my point. Antarctica is not important in world narratives. So,
we get the...
He pretty much leaves her to her own devices, and Stephen wants to storm off because... And it's a really nicely written scene. Yeah. Please, if you're only going to listen to a bit of it, listen to the last part.
I think listening to the last part is good advice, because then you get that speech. And it's the speech in Adventure in Space and Time as well, where the Doctor has this speech where he says everyone leaves him in the end and none of them understood him, not even Susan and things. And he talks about Ian and Barbara.
And Vicky.
And mentions everyone who's been a companion before. Stephen has stormed off because the Doctor hasn't saved everyone, which I would nearly do as well because I'm just sick to death of this. You know, like, everyone gets killed. And here, you know, there's no even sort of redeeming spectacle or anything for 4 previous episodes, and then we get a giant, massacre at the end. So he storms off, and the Doctor gives a spectacular speech, and he really does a great job of it. And in an adventure in space and time, that's the scene where he kind of fluffs it, you know, and loses it, and that's the scene that Gates uses to illustrate that Hartnell's suffering from arteriosclerosis. And it's good that it happens thematically. It happens in a scene where he's reflecting on all of the people who he loved who have left the program. So in an adventure in space and time, Billy ruins that speech. But in the actual show, it's spectacular. It's perfect. He does a great job. Yeah. But then after all of that, Stephen comes back because, like...
A policeman's coming.
Because, you know... And
it's
then,
awful.
And then...
It's
so awful. It all just goes nowhere. We don't learn anything.
Drumroll, we have the introduction of the very... We've just lost a mirror ball off the Chumbly Cake. How prescient is that? Just as we're about to announce the introduction of the new companion.
All together now. Dodo Chaplet.
Now, the giveaway is that she has a name that means stupid person.
She has a name that means extinction.
but, like, dodos are not just dead as a dodo, but they're kind of stupid. You know, like, And so, like, instantly she's on the back foot.
The first thing she says walking into a time and space machine that's dimensionally transcendental is, where's the phone?
And
that's it.
And
that's
it. She has a terrible northern accent, like a terrible fake.
Not for long.
She was meant to be Cockney. And until about the third scene of the
We were thrust out of that.
Are we doing the arc already?
We're in the arc. Here we
are. Oh, sorry, I thought we were.
Thank you all for listening to The Massacre, as I'm sure you've all just gone and done, because it really is the best one ever. Moving on.
Yeah, so by the third scene of the arc, Dodo is no longer Cockney because the big bods at the BBC said you can't.
No, well, because Jared Savory said, I don't want her accent ricocheting up and down the M4, which didn't actually exist at the time. but it really does. No, they said, we still want M4. Yeah, she starts off northern, then goes Cockney, and then goes terribly RP.
Yeah, and from then on, like, by the time of the Celestial Toymaker, she's like a play school presenter with the RP accent. There is an in-story explanation for... Because she says something, and she says something cool or modern. She says something that Christopher Eccleston might say. She says something's dead cool or dead something, or fab or something. Like, she uses some modern language.
She does say it's fab.
Of the kind that Vicky used, sort of, as well. And Hartnell says, oh, you know, we have to teach you to speak proper English, you know. Don't use that appalling mongrel dialect. That's not him. But do you know what I mean? He critiques her speech. And it is that thing, too, where that's the first hint that the Doctor's turning conservative. So the Doctor liked Vicky. No. The Doctor burns down Rome. The Doctor has a happy time. Do you know what I mean?
Like the doctor can't tolerate you cutting your G's. Or
yeah, that's right. But now he's suddenly your primary school teacher. You know, who'll tell you off for having a working class accent.
But he also adopts this girl, and he does adopt her because not only was we mentioned Jackie Lane. Not only was she. He says that she reminds him of his granddaughter that he's lost in extraordinary circumstances because he locked the bloody door and didn't let her back in. I think there's a whole lot of mea culpa in this. I think that you can actually see this as the Doctor having, ever since that moment, just been trying to make it up to whomever he's with.
So and
to
whoever blunders into the TARDIS who had auditioned to play Susan.
Well, this is the point.
You'd auditioned to play my granddaughter.
Jackie Lane did audition. John Wiles had worked with her previously and she was apparently really good and quite respected as a young actor. I don't think it's her fault. I'm going to jump on this again.
It is. Cut. The accent is not good. Like, the accent is not good right
from the
get-go.
Do you know who cuts that? Do you know who actually ordered that? Jared Savory. Jared Savory, who recently appointed head of series and serials, who was getting letters each week from Billy going over John Wiles' head saying, this is happening and it's atrocious and appalling. Savory started taking an interest in the program because he was responding to it. And here's the reason, that as we're going to see later on the season, that Bill is still in the show.
And John Wiles leaves.
Yeah, it's actually pretty much Bill won that round, but not for long, sadly.
Yeah, it's a bit of a Pyrrhic victory, isn't it?
Yeah,
and Wiles really does deal, like, the fatal blow, I think. He's completely sidelined Billy in the massacre.
Yeah.
The arc is his last one, isn't it, John Wiles?
No, it's not his last one. He sticks around for a bit longer, and Billy gets a lot more of a role in the arc, but it is up to Stephen to make the speeches.
Yeah, that's true.
They are, and also, you know, it was around the time of the Mythmakers that Billy was actually diagnosed with arteriosclerosis. So by this time, it was known in the production office that this is why his memory was so bad.
But he still gives great performances later on, and we're going to talk next episode about gunfighters.
Hmm. And some of these savages.
I actually think he's
And savages, he's fantastic.
But, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Sideline. And so, the Ark. Are we talking about the Ark?
We're talking about the Ark.
So, they arrive. I think this is yours, isn't it?
It's a big spaceshipy thing.
It's yours. It is. I've just been riveted by the two of you.
I still want to spend.
Daddy and Daddy are fighting.
Can I spend another 15 minutes talking about how much I hate the massacre?
No.
Okay.
So we have the Ark, which again. Going back to something I was saying about earlier stories, it's a story about one central concept, and it's a story around this concept, which would have been revolutionary at the time. Richard, you alluded earlier in Dalek's Master Plan to the fact that viewers would have no idea when the story would end. So, you know, you get to the end of part two of the arc, and you're like, oh, that was a quick one, but they sorted that out quick, and oh my god, they've gone 700 years in the future, and the statue is finished. It is a powerful cliffhanger, and that's sort of the central idea is, you know, seeing the death of the Earth and then seeing what happens to humanity. But it is very, very problematically done. On one level, it's a very interesting science fiction idea.
Mm.
Richard Shelley.
Well, it's not a new idea. It's Alexander Korda's Things to Come, and it's H.G. Wells, obviously. Olive Stapleton, actually. Mm-hmm. Did you any of you read him when you were at school?
No, but I've heard C.S. Lewis, my mortal enemy, is a big fan of Olive Stapleton.
Olive Stapleton wrote the things about the end of the end of the end of time and books for Sirius, and I think the Last and First Men. They're kind of like Doc Smith. They were, you know, like teenage fiction stuff.
Those. Gosh, they were terrible.
Well, same sort of thing. They're worth looking at, but it's pretty much this story.
Yeah,
far, far, far future.
Because it is super far future. It's well outside where we've ever been.
The 57th segment of time,
and all of Nero and all of those things that we've just seen.
The first segment
everything.
Of
in fact, everything in Doctor Who so far has been the first segment of time. This is.
Except for the Daleks, which happens a million years in the future.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently.
That's 1.5 segment of time.
Yeah.
this is beautifully directed by the one-off Michael Emerson.
Yes,
That first episode is cinematic.
See, I would love to talk about parts one and two and say lovely things, and then parts three and four and just
let's start with parts one and two. Absolutely. It's Things to Come. And it's possibly that the first time that in a science fiction story, Doctor Who is directly copying something else. Because it was...
In terms of design,
certainly earlier on it's taken ideas. But yeah, as you were saying, Richard, it's the first time it's kind of taking the plot from other things and doing it in a Doctor Who kind of way. And what I find very interesting about it is Stephen's big speech when he's on trial. Because they brought Dodo's cold on board. And I don't think that's a great idea to introduce a character to her first full story and she almost commits entire genocide by killing
Imogen. Can we just say, the Doctor then suggests, maybe we've just spread diseases all through space and time in every place we visited ever since the show began.
And not only can he not save everyone. It's too terrible to think about.
He's been infected. People.
Let's not worry about it. Gives a damn, actually, is Stephen.
Yeah, and he has that beautiful speech where, you know, the humans are saying, oh, we're so advanced, oh, we're so marvellous, oh, we're so this, oh, we're so that, and Stephen turns around and says, yeah, but you're still bigoted, terrible people. You know, you are still afraid of anything unlike you, which starts to introduce the tone that's really problematic. Everyone on the ship is white. Except for the monoids.
So the monoids, can we just say for those of you at home who... have, you know, hobbies and full, rich and satisfying lives. And
haven't seen the arc as a result.
Yeah, there's no one, is there? And so they're sort of people and they have sort of waddly legs and dark skin and the people
they have webbed legs. And I don't mean webbed toes.
No, webbed legs.
There is a webbing between their legs.
Yeah, they are. Look, they're John Mandeville's travels through the 18th century or Baron Munchausen's stories, which you'd know from the Terry Gilliam film.
Yeah, the Munchausen.
They're drawn straight from, I'm actually going to hold them up. For the listener at home, because it's the joy of audio. But here we go. I'm just going to show the boys here, and we'll put this up on site. But these are the kind of drawings that were around in the 18th century of creatures with, you know, a ping-pong ball in their mouth and a beetle.
And you get that, like, you do get that stuff. Like, even there's a... In Shakespeare, you know, the anthropophagi and men whose heads do grow beneath their shoulders or between their shoulders.
Yeah, it's from the same thing.
That idea that when you travel,
Caliban's a bit like that.
All of that sort of stuff. But I mean, basically, the idea is they're dark-skinned servants,
Of the monoids are blonde. They're all yak skin. They're all yak hair. You know, some of them are blonde.
They're in beta wigs, and so. They do, like, hilariously bad sign language, and they communicate with sign language, and we're very kind to them, and, you know, they're allowed to kind of, you know, carry our books when we put people on trial and all of that sort of thing. And you know, they start to die of Dodo's cold, and they're a bit upset by that, but no one else is particularly fazed.
They don't do anything until the humans start dying.
Once the humans start dying, then it's like a giant thing, and we'll put everyone on trial.
Yeah.
And so it's already a little bit problematic. Well, no, look, vastly, hugely, hideously problematic and racist. But I kind of wanted to at least say that there are things about the design and the production in those first two episodes which are stunning. Yeah. I mean, the thing vastly better than it had before. Mm. And
I mean, even the costumes, which are a bit silly. Yeah,
It's the Athenian League. You've got to look again at the Anderson.
Well, they're going back in history with the costumes and forward in history. It is an interesting sort of melding to imply that it's this perfect society.
Except that they look like, you know, like a milk bar, like the those strips that hang down on the door. And they're all kind of wearing them no matter how old they are.
Yes.
But you know, the sets are big. They have an elephant. They have an elephant. And like real animals. They have
really nicely. It's done as a cutaway, so you assume it's just another
scene. Yeah, that's right.
And then the cast actually reaches
out. Jodo actually goes out.
That thing's probably died of the flu as well.
Yeah, well, it's Snaid.
Monica's the elephant, yeah.
But then, and that cliffhanger, I agree with you, that cliffhanger. The great thing about it is we even get the sort of, like, we get quite a way into the credits. We may even get the sort of next week, you know, whatever it is, the return. Mm. Like, we get quite a way into it before we see that the head of the statue is a monolith.
Yeah.
So it is, and we linger on that and all of that. And that is really remarkable and really fantastic and something that they've never done before. Like, we've never landed in the same place twice. Right.
Except for Campbell.
Yeah, but
certainly not in a different time period. Yes.
This is one of those stories from our friends who were there for the first time round, along with Web Planet, it seems to be, that are most remembered from the Hartnell era. So, again, because this is a story that's supposed to be propelled by its visual qualities and content rather than its players, because honestly, that security kitchen really gets a workout, doesn't it?
I love the security kitchen.
And it's a good idea. So, you know, the Mono's obviously thinking, well, at least you can bake while you're prisoners. It's actually very modern getting prisoners to
Like the Mono's. And they don't have mouths, right?
No, they have. They have Sonny Bono amulets.
They get served with food and they just kind of look at it.
You do actually see them, like, put it behind their neck.
Oh, do you?
So they've got, like, a neck mouth.
I thought their mouths were in their chests, which is where their voice box things are.
Maybe it was their chest. I thought it was their neck.
It just goes to show how much they pay attention
to this story.
Oh, dear.
But where it all goes to hell, right?
Yeah.
Where it all goes to hell is episode three. And so what's happened is we humans, we lovely white people, have been so kind to the Monoids, you know, by patronising them, allowing them to speak. In fact, we've allowed them, we've taught them to speak.
Yeah, we've allowed them.
We've let them carry our books and drive our things around and all that sort of thing. And then a flu, Dodo's flu, has infected the humans and caused them to lose the will to live. Much like the massacre, actually, has
moving on! Build a cross-channel tunnel.
I'll be back. And suddenly the Monoids are in charge, and they're not the benevolent overlords that the white people were. They're in fact cruel and mean, and they have numbers instead of names, and they explain their plans to each other in loud voices and all of that sort of thing. And the whole thing just sort of goes to hell. It's really just terribly, terribly awful. Are you going to mention Rhodesia?
I was going to mention, I wasn't even going to go to that because we've covered it before, but I was going to mention, you know, John Wiles is an Afrikaner.
He is
a white South African of that time. I don't know what his own political views. Look, I'm prepared to
give
the gentleman the benefit of the doubt simply because he's a man in theatre and a lot of people in theatre had more of a lateral kind of thinking, even in these unprocessed times. But, you know, the people make political thoughts and positions were much more black and white, I guess, in those days, as far as we can see from that.
I saw what you did there.
Yeah, but boom tish. But my personal take on it, this is the one that Wiles wanted to make. This is the one that he
This is his vision of Doctor Who.
It was the very story he wanted to do, which is super duper. It's a lovely idea because, again, it's classic trope, I believe is the word, of science fiction. That it's the super duper arc that's bigger than anything you can possibly film, and giving it to someone a one-off. I think this is an interesting story in a lot of times, a lot of reasons. The director of this story, Michael Emerson, was giving his marching orders. You're not just going off this story. You'll never be hired again by the BBC. And then I think the end of episode one or two, while he was shooting it. So the fact that he carried on might well indicate why episodes 2, 3, and 4 are pretty dull, because the man
I don't think they're
fired.
Badly directed. No, I think it's all down to the script.
Okay,
I think it's all down to the script.
Generous.
So what happens is that the moment that these black people are in control, and we're talking at a time where, as you said before, you know, England's former colonies in Africa are being given kind of self-rule. And so what happens here? The black people are stupid. They explain their plans loudly to each other and tip off the white people. And they fight one another. Do you know what I mean? They can't be trusted not to fight among themselves. And, you know, they're just sort of stupid and primitive. And the whole thing is just absolutely, absolutely monstrous and terrible. The only redeeming feature of episodes 3 and 4 is the fact that the Rafusians have lost their physical shape in a galaxy accident.
Well, fantastic, isn't it? A galaxy accident.
The thing is, even the Rafusian element is incredibly problematic, because Mentos, that's the leader.
Mentos.
Yes. He's the fresh maker.
People, the all-day sucker.
Yeah. Well, he says, we're going to this planet called Refusers 2. It has similar Earth-like properties. And the idea that it will take 700 years to get there, unlike later Doctor Who, this is an era of Doctor Who saying that Earth-like planets are few and far between, which
yeah,
is
exactly.
what we're seeing
exactly.
now when we're looking out into the universe. But
poorly plays of the in either the first
no,
part
the,
or the
none
second.
Of them are particularly interesting.
Yeah, but they're not poorly played.
No,
actors, and there are some interesting moments. And look,
and there's Michael Sheard.
Again, Michael Sheard makes his first of six,
first
I think, appearances. God, I'm such a nerd. it's true. But no, I really think that there are things about this. The fact that it was visually astounding at the time. It got huge coverage here. I've actually got newspapers from the time I found secondhand and saved giving this huge coverage. It got a big promotion by the ABC in Australia when it was shown. Big promotion by the BBC. Visually, it was the show. And the audience figures reflected that, appreciation figures reflected that. And as I say, from fans like my friend Robert living in WA now, he says this and the Web of Fear and the Web Plan are the only ones he remembers as a 7-year-old child watching.
And so when Mentos says that, you know, we're going to this planet, Refuses 2, Stephen says, well, it's either Stephen or Dodo who says, oh, well, aren't there people living there? And it's just pretty much, oh, we'll deal with that when we get there, which in a colonial sense is.
Yeah.
We'll shoot them with our guns until they give us their land. And, you know, we're from Australia. We've seen how that turns out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and but it's all okay, and that whole problem is avoided because the Rafusians are invisible, you know. So,
and in fact,
we're quite happy for you to come in. It's the colonial dream of a native that says, oh, you're so wonderful, why don't you come live in these houses we've built for you?
But they did! They actually did make castles for them. Yeah.
But the Rafusians as well, because they're sort of invisible, godlike entities and
they
stuff.
They certainly speak in a godlike way.
Yeah, yeah. They're the ones who kind of end up as the moral centre of the story. Who tells them that they have to live together?
It's the refusing.
Yeah, you see, they're the ones who enforce. And so,
where's Billy during all of this?
Yeah, oh, you know, faffing about.
He does. Well, I think he is involved in the negotiations.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it is the refusings who kind of deliver the moral. And so they say you have to learn to live together and all of that sort of thing. And you sort of think, oh, maybe this is kind of an attempt to make it into a non-racist thing. But it just doesn't really ring true. And it's come after such horrendous nonsense for the last couple of episodes that you just can't buy it. Do you know what I mean? Maybe the monoids should just learn their place.
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
it's a while before we get to it, but it's a bit like the end of The Two Doctors, where the Doctor says, I think we're going to be vegetarians from now on. It's like, that does not make up for the past 135 minutes of horrible Texas Chainsaw Massacre kind of stuff.
Yeah. No, that's it. That's precisely. They fig leaf the kind of racism, but essentially this is a pretty horrendous racist parable.
It's a shame because the plot on paper is quite interesting.
Yeah, the high concept is great. The design is great. I think it's really well directed. Mm. The whole thing looks spectacular, but it's just horrendous.
I think it could have been saved if, when the Monoids take over, they are actually very good leaders. Like, if they were very good leaders and they were very intelligent, that would have been turning the whole colonialism, nations seeking independence thing on its head. Because when the nations were seeking independence, lots of people were saying, oh, well, they won't be able, you know, they won't be able to run their own country. They need us. If we had have seen the Monoids actually being fairer than the humans, rather than being out and out villains, and it had been a thing of, you know, okay, you're being very fair to them, but they are still your subjects and your prisoners. You must learn to be equal.
Yeah.
That would have said
no. No, I don't think that is because Billy is not angered by the Monoids' oppression in episodes 1 and 2.
He finds
he's
very.
Because
we take it as read that they're not of a sophisticated human level of intelligence, that they don't speak, that they're very robotic in their movement. Mm. We take it that they're only semi-sentient. Yeah. This is why I actually got to argue, since you've had your go on the massacre, but it's not really it's a later reading that this is racist, because these are lizards, they're not people. So you can actually talk about a special form of racism, but I don't think it's a stand-in for humanity. It certainly wasn't seen that way at the time. Okay, yes, you're saying that they were far more unenlightened times. Well, maybe they weren't. Maybe they weren't. Maybe their people were actually a lot more aware of this because the Commonwealth was splitting up. I think people were very aware at the time of
race. That's why I think it's a consciously racist parable.
I don't think it is. Yeah, I think this is lizard guys from the 18th century in beetle wigs stomping around being mean.
Well, they're servants, dark-skinned servants. It's black and white television. They're black.
That's not enough to make it.
Yeah, it really is.
I think it is racist. I do not think it is actively racist. I think it's racist in the same way as early Warner Brothers and Disney cartoons.
They're really racist.
Yes.
That's a bad thing.
But listen. At the time, they were not setting out to be racial vilification. They were setting out to be amusing and missing. And not getting it right. But as Whoopi Goldberg says, because the Looney Tunes DVDs come with an intro by Whoopi Goldberg saying, you know, I loved Looney Tunes as a kid.
Yeah.
And what you're about to see, some of these things, they're racist, they were wrong then, they are wrong now. But if we deny it happened, if we deny that this was a form of entertainment, that's as bad as saying it never happened.
Mm.
And that's why, in a way, this is an important Doctor Who story, because no Doctor Who story after this is as problematic in terms of race.
Except for the next one, obviously.
Well,
yeah, okay, it's not quite as problematic. But
it's one scene in that's problematic.
No. The whole sort of, we'll get there.
Yeah.
We'll get there. There's more than that. The key word is celestial. Yeah, I actually genuinely think that this is a story that the writer is in control of, and that the writer is deliberately choosing to say that that the people to whom we are giving independence in Africa are unable to govern themselves, and that it's genuinely
the producer's point
seeking.
Of view. May have been.
But that's what the story seems to be.
But we don't know that's Paul Erickson's point of view.
I'm of the perspective that somewhere along the line, I think it becomes that, whether it starts out
maybe it doesn't
like
come
that,
from the
whether,
writer.
Or whether it is designed like that, who knows. The designer is Barry Newbury.
I don't mean the designer, I mean the writer. Erickson. Mm. Like, I'm not saying that Erickson, I don't know who's responsible for it, but the story that we have essentially has that as a message.
Hmm. Right, well.
But otherwise, it was terrific. You know, it was great.
Yeah. So I think we can boil that down to it's a great concept.
I'd like to know what other people, if anyone is listening to this, what you think yourself. If you could just leave a comment on the Facebook page
or on the website.
Yeah, or the website even better, because you know some of our people have already been leaving. Greg's left great comments just on what they think. Do you think it's racist? I said my piece, and you certainly heard from the rest of us.
We seem to be sort of coming from three different perspectives of not racist, entirely racist,
I don't think
and
it's intentionally
a little bit
so.
Racist.
I don't believe it's intentionally so, no.
Yeah, so I think we can sort of boil that down to it's a great concept, but with very, very questionable execution. And speaking of questionable execution, we're off into a land of dreams and fantasy.
Is this the one where I get to talk for 15 minutes about how much I hate the massacre again?
No!
Oh, okay. That it's is my fantasy, though.
It's the Celestial Toymaker.
All right. Those chimes in the willow tree starting to go off now. This one's been given to me because I'm the lucky one. This is another one of those things that on paper should have been extraordinary. It does and says things about, you know, the Doctor facing a godlike villain, the ultimate power, gods and monsters thing of, you know, being taken out into a form of reality that's beyond the reality of the universe that we know. We're going through Brian Greene's black hole. He wasn't even around in those days. But black holes had actually only... Hang on, hadn't even been promulgated yet. Black holes were only a year old when they made The Three Doctors.
Yeah.
That's how early we are.
Is that true?
Yeah, yeah,
that's
72.
Right. It was a very new idea.
71, 72. So, and it turns out Doctor Who got it totally right. Spoiler alert for...
Really? There's like ancient Time Lord with a sort of magical realm.
Stop it.
Do you know that there isn't? You weren't there.
Exactly.
You don't know.
You don't, it's right.
Sorry, Judith.
Judith is here in the room with us. This should have been amazing. And you can see why fans like Gary Russell and the other guys were saying that, you know, in
Jeremy Bentham.
In the memory of... Nathan, do you actually have a copy of Peter Haining's Celebration?
It just so happens I do.
With you at this very moment. And we're going to relate this to the gentle listener, because I think you've got to be reminded of just what the received idea of this was. It's the Doctor meeting finally his equal in a universe, in a part of a world that doesn't belong in space and time as we know it, that there are archetypes of not just villains, but of characters that we only realise halfway through the narration were once people but have been denuded to be mere automatons and mere dolls. There's some really dark ideas in this.
Yeah.
And yet,
it's really terrible. It never quite pulls them off. You're so sweet, Brendan. It's awful
from
beginning to end.
Like we were discussing earlier, my function at this podcast is to go, but everything's wonderful.
Everything's something. So I'm not going to read...
I threw my hands above my head there, dear listener, like Nadia Comaneci.
So I have Doctor Who A Celebration by Peter Haining, and this is a hugely important document because it's the 20th anniversary thing, so it's 1983.
It's 1983.
It's before very
much...
Which
was a very good year, listener.
Brendan's first viewing.
Really? That was our first viewing of Brendan?
Well, it was his moment of, remember, when we were born. Yeah.
Browning.
This is it.
Yes.
So 1983, and had there been any DVD releases? Had there been any VHS releases?
The Cybermen came out that time on VHS, and it cost the equivalent of $80.
Yeah, just couldn't watch old Doctor Who.
No.
If you lived in Australia, you were very lucky because they were stripping it on the ABC, and we got to see things over and over again.
Yes.
But essentially, you could never watch old Doctor Who. And so this was most people's only source for, you know, what the old stories had been like.
Yeah.
And this one raves about Celestial Toymaker. I'm going to read one sentence because reading things out on the podcast that would kill our momentum stone dead.
Maybe I can add an echo to you.
Bing! Do that. Few drama productions on television have ever achieved the unique atmosphere present in the four episodes of The Celestial Toymaker.
What does this say about the character of the Toymaker himself, though? Because he's seen as being extraordinary. I've got a bit to say about him. He's really Sax Romer's again. Fu Manchu. He's Ming the Merciless.
It's another racist and Celestial.
Flash Gordon. Oh, Celestial was a buzzword.
Thank you to Sandifar.
Well, it's actually a 19th century thing for Chinese and
it means
connotes
drug-addled
person. Yeah, it does.
He Chang in Talents of Wing Chiang calls himself the Celestial
Chang.
And apparently in Deadwood, Celestial gets used as a term of abuse. But I've never seen Deadwood, so God knows whether that's true.
Lloyd, is Innes Lloyd involved in this one?
Innes Lloyd and Gerry Davis are starting to come
around.
This is during the handover, so this is at the point where we're at a weird transition, because, of course, the Doctor disappears for half of this story, more than half of this story.
Yeah.
And that was as a result of John Wiles still trying to get rid of Hartnell. And the original idea for changing the actor, which was vetoed by Gerald Savoy.
Savory.
Yeah. Savory, I do beg your pardon.
Savory.
Vetoed by Gerald Savory was that the toy maker would make the Doctor disappear, and then when he came back, he would be
a new actor,
but the same persona.
Yeah.
So he would have the same look, but be a different actor. And that was vetoed, and I think that was actually the straw that broke the camel's back for Wiles, who just kind of turned around and said, "Look, you want me to make this show, but I cannot make this show because the lead actor is impossible for me to work with. Yeah. Therefore, I will not make the show. I will quit."
Yeah, Billy won that round, and of course, Billy was. But it's also because in this story, Gerald Savory himself had immediate involvement in it. Where this comes from, can we just briefly say the TARDIS appears in something that is like the land of fiction.
Only crummy.
The doctor suddenly turns somewhat invisible and all the rest of it turns amazing completely.
So the Doctor has to play Towers of Hanoi with Michael Goff, and he's invisible and then inaudible, and it's hand moving the things.
So the companions have to step out of the TARDIS, and they find themselves in a land of one-to-one scale toys. A nice little thing of Planet of Giants, again, where you think that the TARDIS can take on the scale of whatever universe it's in.
Yeah, yeah.
There's kind of really exciting things that are happening here. The idea of these, and the design is actually gorgeous for a show with no budget. The tin robots of man size.
They're wonderful. Terrific.
With TV sets in their chest. Especially in the colour photos that you can see of this. They're really gorgeous looking. And Michael Goff, of course, has come straight from the Avengers, where he was the inventor of the Cybernauts. Absolutely the precursors to Doctor Who's Cybermen a year later. Really nicely done. Now, this is actually the story that on paper was supposed to propel the idea of Doctor Who as an international saleable commodity online with the Avengers. And this story itself is the story that is supposed to mime or mimic what the Avengers is doing. They did it beautifully with the kind of the fantasy and reality. The house that Jack built, thank you. Which in itself actually kind of references the TARDIS. It's an Emma Peel story where a house is actually built just to menace the chief protagonist, in this case, Mrs. Peel. So the idea of this one was that it would be that it would actually be something that would be everyone would love and the Americans would want to watch and buy, whereas it's really just two people running around playing really rubbish children's games with no narrative connection
bad.
At all. It's extraordinary
so
to watch just how dull it is to actually have to sit through.
And it is. And there's no real peril, or there's no sort of properly to you know, we'll be burned or whatever. And
it's got lines like, "What have you done now, you clown, you?" Well, the clowns aren't even scary clowns.
As Rod said at the time, because I've got my notebook here, "I wish they would stop talking about the solutions and actually do them. When it occurs to them in the first 10 minutes of each episode,
this is such a
waste."
And he's so right. You know, this comes from absurdist theatre, which is very Ionesco, Eugenie Ionesco.
Yeah, but
the rhinoceros.
That's good. You know, this is really
but
not
on paper.
Absurdist.
This was the same thing. This is also absurdist theatre. If you don't know, it is about the futility of the mundane and the everyday of life, and juxtaposed with fantasy, with very dark notions of where we are. It also presages Joe Orton's work, because it's very much like Orton's later. And in fact, you've got Dodo dressed as Joe Orton in the train driver's cap. And you know, Harold Pinter, of course. And people
were
watching that.
Yeah, but those are good. You
they
know,
are.
Like, and there's...
Do you know what this is? You can actually say existentialism without blanching. This idea is existentialist theatre. But as you say, there's none of the production or the writing that holds that together.
There's no threat. There's no... Like, all we have to do is get the TARDIS. Everything's completely arbitrary.
You know why?
The threat is only explained to us in dialogue and we never see it. No actual characters anywhere. The games are deadly boring and protracted. It really is. I mean, it may be my least favourite Doctor Who story. It's terrible.
The reason that exists is because it was all taken out, and that was by the head of series and serials. Gerald Savory,
Had written a play in the 30s called George and Margaret. The characters George and Mildred from Man About the House and later their own show were based on that. Shades of Samuel Beckett, maybe. The characters of George and Margaret never actually show up in this play. The other characters sitting around waiting for them, and there's the drama of, you know, it's the existential loss of living in an urban environment, blah, blah, in Britain in the 1930s. It was still considered quite a literary piece and was very well known enough for the casual viewer to have actually known who these people were. The idea of this one was that George and Margaret are played by Carmen Silvera and Campbell Singer, and they're actually in this. So it's a kind of part two. What happens when you explore this really interesting, take literary values and put them into a reality? So the TARDIS can actually fly into the land of fiction. We know that now. But Gerald Savory, because he was siding with Billy on this and hearing that Wiles was corrupting the show, then thought, no, you're not having my characters, looked at the scripts and said, oh, actually, this, no. So the reason Wiles left is because of this story, and the reason Billy is here stayed on because of this story, and the reason it's pants is because of the politics going on at the time.
Because otherwise, explicitly, you know, Joey and Clara, the King and Queen, Sergeant Rugg and Mrs. Wig would have been the same character. They would have been George and Margaret all the way through.
Doesn't that sound interesting?
And then, you know, you've got that extra tension of, I believe at the time, George and Margaret was actually being performed and it was very big in London.
Oh, okay.
And that was where Brian Hale's idea came from. You know, these characters never show up. Wouldn't it be great to use these characters? To which Donald Tosh said, oh, well, that's our boss. I'm sure he'll let us.
Yeah. He did it first.
Well, he did it first, until the scripts were written, and then went, no, you can't have them.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that takes a big part of the wind out of the sails. You know, it would be like David Whittaker writing The Crusade, and then the sort of family trust of King Richard saying, no, you can't use King Richard.
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of narrative core taken out of it.
You would probably spend watching it.
Oh, yeah. It's really rough. I mean, it really is so boring. And
Michael Goff is good.
Yeah.
Well, okay. But,
I mean, he just spends a lot of time declaiming to an empty room. Look, I'm someone who loves, you know, this is the first of...
It's very 60s.
Well, it's the first of a series of sort of Doctor Who stories like The Mind Robber or The Macra Terror.
Or The Greatest Show in the Galaxy, which I think is a remake
of
this.
All of which I think are great, but this is just awful. And it is because there's no plot. There's just a bunch of things that happen. You know, you get to the end of the level and you get the TARDIS and the crappy rhyme, which then appears over the credits. Mm. And then you get to the next level and stuff. It's something that could have gone on for like 50 episodes. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's
something that doesn't help. Is that when they were planning on bringing the Toy Maker back in the 1980s, and they were planning on making
Nightmare Fair,
they were planning on making it about video games and amusement parks. Now,
I've read the book; it's not that bad.
And the thing is, as much as you go, oh, I don't know if that would work. That is the modern entertainment of that era.
Yeah.
Whereas the games they are playing seem to me not to be the modern entertainment of the 60s. You know, even the dancing bit.
Yeah.
It's ballroom dancing and it's ballet. It's not groovy house dancing that we'll see in just a few stories in The War Machines.
But isn't the point of it, it's Victorian children's literature? Like, it has
it's a whole Lewis Victorian Carroll.
Thing.
Yeah, but I think it would have been far more effective if it had been stuff that children in the 60s would more easily recognise.
But you know what?
I mean, imagine if they had have just gone, right, we can't use the meta of this play we wanted to use. Let's use the meta of Doctor Who. Let's have Stephen and Dodo playing Daleks around a dance floor.
It's Doctor Who does pop symbolism as it was in 1965. It's actually Carnaby Street stuff. Lewis Carroll was getting a huge revival. Animation styles. Later on, you're going to see Yellow Submarine with the Beatles using the same kind of language, visual language. It's very much what's groovy right now. And then it just goes, because you know what? Ideas are great. Visual cues are great. But you've got to have a script.
You've got to have characters and you've got to have a plot. And you don't have either of those here.
It needed a lot of work. It was a rushed thing.
You can see
this is a political deflation of the Doctor Who program where some people win, but as you said, it's a Pyrrhic victory for our hero, Billy.
I don't think so much that it was a rushed script. I think the rewrite was rushed.
The rewrite was very much
rushed. It was essentially rewritten from the ground up by Jerry Davis.
You know who we haven't mentioned? Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of Mr. Davis, as you're going to find out.
Mm.
We haven't mentioned
Jackie Lane's portrayal of Dodo in this.
Oh, dear. Even,
oh, yeah, it's so...
And so now she's got a received pronunciation accent, and she's like a Blue Peter presenter.
But I don't think she's got much to do, but she seems to play her part in this show as if she is a Blue Peter presenter. I think she's been told she's playing a show for four-year-olds, and she's ridiculously thought that that's true.
And yeah, just
Doctor Who is not a children's program.
Dodo in this story is ridiculously stupid.
But do you think they're both on mock? Do you think they're both drugged out of their minds?
Because they found Adrienne Hill's stash in the TARDIS.
But the thing is, if she was going to play it like that, they should have thrown in a line about how she's being affected by the environment. Because in the last episode, which we still
there's no tension. Yeah,
I mean, the last episode, I would say, is the best of the four.
I'd like
to say nearly over.
There's some stuff that happens that finally has some drama.
Yeah, they have a decent adversary. Cyril is quite interesting.
The Billy Bunter character is terrific.
Yeah, again, another character they thought
stole.
I'd like to know what older fans who were there for the first time around and, you know, didn't remember it so well, but what they think about it now.
Yeah. Well, Rod did say, because, as I've said before, he started watching Patrick Troughton, and he said, if I had seen this when I was a child, I would have switched off.
Really? Oh, what did he give it?
He gave it 1 out of 10.
Wow, he's a generous man.
Which is his second lowest score.
And yet at the time, people thought it was great.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were crazy. Well, they just finished rationing.
No, I think because it hits all the pop images of the time. Visually, kids remember it as being cool because it looks like it should be right.
Last episode, when we were talking about things like the Web Planet, you mentioned people being on substances and whatnot.
Yes.
I think this is another one that would have been very popular with the students, the older university, college, polytechnic students.
You think so? Yeah, really? Maybe, yeah.
I think you would have had... For the visual imagery.
Yeah.
I thought the Ark maybe, or definitely the Web Planet, maybe more of that. The viewers still stayed around 9 million for this. They didn't go below 8.9.
They had nothing else to do. What were they going to do? Watch
ITV?
Yeah. I suppose they didn't analyze it and talk about it.
Richard.
Yeah.
You didn't watch that.
It did, but, you know, it's...
Yeah, terrible.
What to be say.
All right, well, that's a lovely way to... Are we concluding our episode?
I think we are. I mean,
we've just been bitching non-stop.
Well,
can we? If we could just go for another 15 minutes, so that I could talk about how much I hate the massacre, that would be a perfect ending to this episode,
and probably the loss of the listener as well.
Really?
I think that would be a perfect ending to you going home and doing that by yourself. But I think
I actually write out things about how much I hate the massacre and tape them to telephone poles.
Oh, that's you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Or sample picks up.
So, someone's actually given your picture of Leonard Sachs as the Admiral Dick Holding an even bigger moustache.
Elaborate.
But no, I think it just goes to
massacre,
I think it just goes to show. I mean, these three stories are the three stories when John Wiles was in total control.
Yeah.
It just shows how terrible he was for Doctor Who. You know, I don't want to say anything against the man. Obviously, he's no longer with us, and I know very little about him outside of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
But
He did kick puppies, though, I'm told.
Well,
his background is
he ate them.
His background is in children's theatre for the deaf. I'd like to think that
he's a nice person.
That there's more to him than that, yeah.
So,
I think he had a lot of battle with Billy, and he was coming in on the back of, you know, an extraordinary producer, and...
He probably only kicked puppies on really bad days, when he was, like, really cross.
Yeah, well, you know what, that's the thing. Everyone's got their own story, and when we come down to it, each of these stories does have something to redeem them.
Yeah.
Even in The Celestial Toymaker.
Well, it's only 4 episodes. I mean, it could have been 8. It could have been 20.
It's only 4 episodes. Michael Gough's very good in it.
Okay.
The Ark has a really good idea behind it. And The Massacre is brilliant. And as we're ending now, you're not going to say anything else,
it's
Nathan.
It's beautifully written.
Good night.
Good night. And the Massacre is terrible.
Thank you very much for taking a bipartisan view on this, dear listener. Thank you. Bye.
You have been listening to Flight Through Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. This episode, Someone Lost Their Beagle, was recorded on Sunday, the 10th of August. The next episode will be released on September 14th. You can find us at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FTE Podcast on Twitter. If we are to play endless games together, my choice is Mario Kart.
This is Flight Through Entirety. Now, what was my thing? What stories are we doing? Who am I?
The Ark. We're the only podcast without a ping pong ball in our mouth.
That's so funny.